Well, yeah.
You are an enemy if you retreat in front of a commissar.
Okay, crosses the commissar's event horizon.
Right.
Live from the Mundangerous Gravity Well in New York City, I'm your host Shane.
And I'm your host Yishin.
And welcome to episode 154 of Total Party Thrill, a podcast for game masters and players where we discuss our campaigns in order to inspire yours.
In this episode, we're talking about how evil is too evil. But first, the rogue traders dodge a bullet in the Dynasty Unwarranted campaign. And later, Sub-Zero gives enemies the cold shoulder and everything else in the Character Creation Forge.
So, Ishan, it would not be convention season if there weren't new games on the horizon. We got a couple of exciting ones, I think, coming up.
Yeah, we've been waiting for this one for a while, because I believe the 40K game that we are playing, we are running with a totally defunct out-of-print game.
Totally defunct and out-of-print. The latest game for a few more days, but totally defunct and out-of-print, yeah.
However, we are getting a new 40K game, Wrath and Glory, by Ulysses Spiel,
Ulysses
right?
Spiele, yeah.
Very German, very appropriate.
Right. So they're running a pre-order on their website, and it is quite an expensive pre-order. They're kind of running it like a Kickstarter, but not with a public funding amount. I think they're a public company, so that's kind of a challenge to do a Kickstarter. But yeah, so like the more people back, the more things they release as part of the Kickstarter package.
I don't know if you know this, Shane, but being a podcaster is a really easy way to make a lot of money without a lot of work. So I think we should just take all of the money from our giant coffers and buy this thing.
As a podcaster, I did not know that being a podcaster was an easy way to make a lot of money without a lot of work.
Oh, I'm embezzling.
Dang. Beat me to it. It's like, I think the all-in like GM package starts at like $290, and like with special edition covers and stuff like that, it gets up to like almost $400. So it's a pretty chunk of change.
Yeah, the main reason that when I play 40K, I play the RPGs and not the tabletop is that I don't have all of that money to spend.
Well, actually, so funny you mentioned that. Not exactly in our wheelhouse, but they just announced 40K Kill Team, which is the skirmish version of Warhammer 40K as well. So it's supposed to be for like 5 to 10 models per side. So perhaps that could help you find a way to relieve some dollars from your wallet.
Oh, dear Lord. Okay, now I just need storage space in a New York City apartment.
But only...
No big deal.
Only 5 models. I have 5 models sitting on my desk right now.
I think I have a grand total of 5. We talked about this in the miniatures episode, okay?
Yeah.
Like, I whatever I can fit in my dice bag along with the dice.
Right. So exciting new 40K products coming to suck all of the extra dollars out of your pocket. And speaking of sucking things out of you.
Hey!
Yikes.
The 5th edition, I can't believe I'm saying this, the 5th edition of Vampire the Masquerade is coming out July 26th. And actually, we've got a digital preview copy in hand right now that we will be reviewing for you. And that episode will actually be out on July 26th.
Yep. So this one was written by Kenneth Height.
Sorry, who?
Just a guy named Ken Height. I don't know. He's got like an Any or 30.
Oh, right. And a few games under
books.
His belt, I suppose.
Yeah, for both books and podcasts, frustratingly. So he wrote Knights Black Agents, which is a game that we adore, as well as a handful of different supplements and modules. He's worked on a lot of great games. So he's one of the designers that I trust implicitly. So I am definitely excited to be digging into Vampire.
Yeah, not too long ago, we actually did, we covered the Vampire the Masquerade campaign setting in our campaign setting series. And, you know, those of you who listen to that know that neither of us were like big White Wolf or vampire players back in the day, but we both appreciate the setting, especially because, you know, it sort of gave birth to like the Underworld movies and took a lot from Anne Rice novels and things like that. Gothic horror is a thing we're both interested in. So I am definitely really excited to see where this next edition takes it. It's it's kind of a throwback to the original, the Masquerade, rather than the... What was the second edition of it, where they sort of...
Requiem.
They 90s did up even more and took out a lot of the biblical references. A lot of those are back now, so I think it's going to be cool. A lot of the art is already out and looks really impressive. I think we're just not quite sure about the mechanics, but we'll see. And speaking of being completely unsure, Shane, where are we in the Dynasty Unwarranted campaign?
So the Dynasty Unwarranted campaign is our Warhammer 40K Rogue Trader game, played using Dark Heresy 2nd Edition rules by Fantasy Flight Games. And on the Dead World Malajact, the Rogue Traders and their two best companies of armsmen have located the Verza House, an ancient obsidian fortress once occupied by the fallen Dark Angel, Lord Cypher.
We are getting shot at. A lot.
Uh-huh. You guys are under heavy assault. And your character, Trank, and the Heretic, Doc, are attempting to organize the defense. How's that going, Ishan?
Really, really well. Everyone's really organized. We're crack shots, and there aren't that many enemies. Actually, of that is a lie. Every single bit of that is a lie. We did find awesome heavy weapons in the armory. They're like thousands of years old. They are Laz cannons. Like, they're too big for one person to kind of hold, so you just sort of like prop one end up and like one person loads it, and it shoots like this crazy energy beam where, like, if you hit any part of a person, they get vaporized, which is like great, right? Like, Trank is sort of forgetting that, like, we're losing this battle because he's just shooting a new gun.
Yep.
But we're losing this battle.
You're losing the battle. Yeah, so the artillery barrage has fallen off. The enemies have begun scaling your defenses, and they have breached the casements. They are now inside the house, and you are ordering a organized retreat. That's the right way to describe it, right?
Yeah, they're literally in the walls, man.
And meanwhile, the nerds, Trix, Echo, and Flair, your seneschal, your quartermaster, and your astropath, respectively, are racing through the unexplored reaches of the house. They are drawn by this suspicion that there's got to be some valuable secret lurking within the house that they can use, and they are trying to figure out what that is before you guys lose your heads in defense.
They're getting really eager because the situation is so desperate, and so they are just barreling through different hallways, smashing through doors, and Trix runs out into this new courtyard that they find, and then a shot rings out.
Yeah, time slows down, kind of Trix sees this Laz bolt headed straight for his head, you know, his life starts to flash before his eyes.
It's not a pretty life.
No, but it is a life. and he is, you know, making peace with it. And then out of nowhere, the old dame leaps in, throws him aside, casts him to the ground, and before he even realizes what has happened, she disappears.
Wait a minute, the old dame. I thought she was just a figment of his imagination, a terrifying ghost with a meat face.
Yes, and also was haunting him, and he suspected was trying to kill him.
And yet now has saved him.
Yes, yes.
Perhaps for a worse fate.
Right. So, that worse fate arrives as more shooters approach from the roof of this courtyard from the far side and begin shooting at the rogue traders. But Trix is alive, which is better than he would have been.
Yeah, he didn't get his head blown off right now. So they make it through a series of hallways and chambers and find themselves in a library, which is littered with books and old parchments. Now, they've got their sage, the quartermaster Echo, along with them, so they can make a little bit of sense of like this sort of like proto-Gothic script. It's before even low Gothic or like old school high Gothic that sages use.
Yeah. And being like not really able to interpret it, they figure this can't be it. So they start to move on until Flair stops suddenly and gets very focused on a single book sitting on the shelf.
I wish Flair would stop more suddenly, or just stop it all. Stop it.
So he sees this book and gets fixated on the symbol embossed on its spine. A chitinous white snake curled into a circle, biting its own tail.
And we'll find out what that means next week.
So this week, we are talking about crossing the moral event horizon. Ishan, what's an event horizon?
It's a terrifying movie that was completely miscategorized as a sci-fi movie when it's actually horror. And then so when like young Ishin goes to the movie theater and is like, yeah, let's see some like space fighting and Starship Troopers. And then it turns out that people's are getting turned inside out and hung by their skin. Mm-hmm. He doesn't like it.
Yeah.
That's Event Horizon.
And you thought Lawrence Fishburne was going to deliver you. He did not.
I thought Sam Neill would tell me some cool stuff about dinosaurs.
Yeah.
And that didn't happen.
That really was a perfect casting job to just trick like 10 to 16-year-old boys.
Yeah. Yeah. I still don't like to think about it.
Okay, so what is a moral Event Horizon?
Okay. So like in scientific terms, an event horizon is the point at which the closest point anything can be to a black hole and still have a chance of escaping that gravity well. It's essentially a way of saying it's the point of no return. You know, once you go beyond this, there's no going back. So the moral event horizon is the action a character takes where everyone decides, oh, I see. They are irredeemably evil. There is no redemption for this. They have decided to join the dark side forever and ever, period. And this could be because they've, you know, actively made a decision, like, oh, now I'm going to be a bad guy, or I have always been a bad guy and I'm pulling the mask off. Or it could just be, even if the writer or the player didn't necessarily intend for it, the other players or the audience can no longer like buy into a redemption arc. Like it just doesn't even make any sense anymore.
Yeah, you do one genocide and no one really cares if you become a good person after that.
See, that's what I'm saying, right?
Fittingly, I just watched Inglourious Basterds on Showtime.
Very nice. See, it's nice that I now know that one genocide and only one genocide is beyond your moral event horizon. It's nice to know. I wasn't completely sure about that.
To be clear, that is beyond. That is not the line.
I mean, half a genocide. I mean, come on.
I'm not sure what distribution of genocide is required. There is definitely a point, and one is over it.
If people are looking at us, stroking their chin and going, is this a genocide? That's it. We're done. Like, certainly too far.
Right.
All right. So in role-playing games, though, there are a couple reasons why thinking about when you actually cross over beyond the point of no return is important. And it's usually when you're dealing with NPCs, because you kind of need to know, if you're running a game, how much bad stuff a particular NPC can do before the party decides that they're going to stop being nice to them, or that they're going to stop trying to redeem them, right? You get a lot of these characters where the party's like, I don't know, maybe there's just some way we could turn them to our side. And you want to know at the point when the party's like, oh, nope, we're done, not doing that anymore.
Yeah, and that's not just for like terribly evil NPCs, right, who have these mad schemes and want to commit genocide or bring to birth evil gods or whatever, right? Like, this includes, like, goblins. Goblins are inherently somewhat evil, and maybe that alone is enough for the PCs to never think of giving them redemption, right? They just kill them on sight. And so it's good to know that that line exists as a GM, because you plan your session around it. You, when they see goblin, they think fight.
Yeah. Or maybe you want to run like an Eberron game or a game with gray morality. You already have in your head, okay, players are predisposed to think of goblins as evil. If I want to play goblins as, you know, people who make decisions about their own lives and they decide whether, you know, they're going to be good or bad, if I start off with having them like slaughter a caravan of travelers, well, guess what? They've just crossed that moral event horizon. We are done with like neutral or gray goblins in this game.
Yeah, you've got to have those goblins saving that caravan. And then probably saving another caravan, because the PCs will assume it's a long con.
This is also really important. It's an important concept for gray or even just evil PCs. Because if you're playing one of these characters, you really need to keep tabs on how bad or evil you can be before a redemption arc for you isn't going to make any sense anymore. And like, even if you don't want to play a redemption arc, even if you're like, oh, I'm evil and I'm going to be more evil and eventually I betray the party, like that's your arc that you've planned for this character between you and the GM, you need to know how far you can go before everyone else is like, oh, okay, hey, we're murdering you and we're leaving you behind.
Yeah, and that's not just for, again, terribly heinous acts, but this gets into like the rogue and the paladin, like that old trope, right? Like, how much stuff will the paladin let you steal before the paladin smites you?
Yeah, where is the paladin's line for that moral event horizon? Like, oh no, I didn't kill anyone. I just took their stuff. yes, and now they're going to starve in the desert.
Right, I just left them destitute. 3 kids, no jobs. Weird.
All right, as it may already seem clear, a lot of this is really down to the adjudication of, like, what is enough or what is too much. Whether that's, you know, the GM, a person who's playing the PC, or really more often the rest of the party. And this is really different for everyone. Like, think about popular media. At what point in Star Wars is Darth Vader no longer a redeemable character? Well, according to George Lucas, never. He's always redeemable, all the way through the end, right? Like, well, he blows up a planet, and then, like, at the end, he gets to turn into a Force spirit and chill with Ewoks.
Yeah, true. Kind of.
Okay, but for me, for Ishan's moral event horizon, once he blows up Alderaan, it's over, all right? Nothing else after that makes sense in terms of, like, him being a good person. Like, okay, it's cool that, like, oh, my son is dying and, like, I don't want my son to die. Great, you killed like 8 billion people. Okay,
yeah, so there's that. That's one genocide.
Yeah, and then if you watch the prequels, I still am like, oh no, yeah, you killed those younglings. I'm like, just losing your arms and legs was like too good. You okay. Know what I mean? Like,
all right, but hang on, so
hold on. Okay,
so I don't think it's fair to count the younglings, because obviously that was written post facto. Because
they're not even people, really.
No, because that was written after the fact. So if he was redeemable at the end, like, the younglings can't then invalidate that. You're watching the movies in the wrong order.
Oh, yeah, yeah. No, I'm saying, okay, when I watched the original trilogy, I was done at Alderaan.
Yeah, yeah. So there's that.
Yeah, and if you're looking at the character, like, as a whole, like, in terms of, like, in universe, looking at Anakin, then I'm like, oh, younglings, you're out. You're out, man.
Yeah, but so where does the free will come into this, right? Because, like, at the point that was written, the dark side was sort of seducing Anakin and sort of driving that particularly evil behavior, right? It wasn't really Anakin who was doing that.
And see, that's a really good point. I think we'll get into that a little more deeply later, but there are always mitigating circumstances.
Right.
Sometimes.
Right.
Like, maybe it was the succubus. It wasn't me.
Yeah,
it was the succubus.
Exactly. You know, if you're in the thrall of the mind flayer, is it really your fault if you do bad things when you're just a puppet?
That's what I'm saying. There's always a secret mind flayer.
I suppose that is a very liberal interpretation of the dark side, though.
You're not in control of your own self. Yeah, yeah. Palpatine's a mind flayer.
Yeah. Anyway. To bring it back to the character perspective and not just the audience perspective, right? Like, it's very dependent on the alignment of the other characters and how it compares to what they would do in that situation.
Yeah, to take it back to our, like, rogue and paladin, if the rogue is just stealing their stuff and leaving people destitute, a certain paladin might be like, okay, this is not worth killing the rogue over, but, like, I'm going to bring them to justice. A different paladin who's like, someone stole all of my family's stuff, and we were destitute, and then, like, the rest of my family died until I was taken in by the church, might be like, hey, guess what? Now I'm definitely murdering you.
Yeah, and then an even more pacifistic character might say, rather than addressing the rogue in a way that's going to hurt the rogue, might simply kind of try to make up for it behind the scenes, right? Like, make the family whole, or whatever it is that the rogue is doing that's so bad.
Yeah, exactly. Like, the neutral monk might just be like, all right, I give you more of my stuff, and then treat the rogue with an eye roll.
Right.
I feel like a lot of this, a lot of its characters sort of compare the actions of other characters, whether they're NPCs or other players, sort of to what actions they would take in the same situation. I sort of think of it like the speed limit. You know, you're driving and you drive at a particular speed, and anyone who's driving slower than you, you eye roll and you're like, you could be doing so much more. And anyone who goes just a tiny bit faster than you is like, oh my God, you're insane. What's wrong with you? You should go to jail. I think the moral event horizon is sort of the same thing. If you're like gooder than me, fine, whatever, you know, you're a goody two shoes. As soon as you do one thing I would not do, I judge you and say, oh, that is beyond the pale. I'm sorry, my friend. Like, you're done.
Okay.
Is that just me? Is it just me?
Seems...
Look, for the record, I would not have blown up Alderaan.
I just like that you will never hold yourself to a higher standard. I appreciate that about you.
You're very welcome.
You always hold yourself to the lowest common denominator.
Look, I would have killed like three younglings before I was like, hold on a second.
Never aspire to be better. Great. Got it. All right. So another thing that drives this is not simply the characters in the audience, but also the conventions and tropes of the genre itself. So the tone and setting of your game are also going to inform this.
Yeah, if you're playing a game set in the DC Comics universe, killing one person, no matter how evil they are, is probably like past the line for most superheroes. You know, Batman won't kill the Joker, even though, let's be honest, the Joker totally deserves it, which is why Batman is neutral evil.
That's why he's evil, yeah. Refuses to deal with evil reasonably.
He deserves death!
In contrast, Warhammer 40K has a pretty broad base for how evil you can be in the name of the Imperium. Doesn't care so much for those Xeno species or chaos cultists or even the risk of chaos. May draw a line at cannibalism, I don't know.
Yeah, 40K is interesting because it's like, if you're not committing genocide, then you have crossed the moral event horizon because you have let chaos go loose.
Right, yeah.
And yeah, I guess we'll get to this later in our 40K game. But yeah, we had a nice moment where it was like, yeah, we'll sell terrible things and we'll do arms deals, but eating people.
Yeah, which is funny because I don't actually think cannibalism is a particularly like evil piece of like 40K lore.
It's like, good to know about you.
I mean, there is at least one example in the Abnetverse where non-chaos cultists were forced to cannibalism. The Urdeshi people had to resort to cannibalism to survive during chaos occupation.
I mean, a succubus made them do it, right?
I mean, the best they could do. That was the whole problem at like Ancreon Sextus or whatever, right? When Wilder was commanded. Anyway, no more Gaunt's ghosts.
Look, sometimes eating people is okay. Usually it is not.
Yeah, totally a genre convention thing, right? Because like a lot of times in post-apocalyptic settings, that is a hard limit, right? Like you never resort to cannibalism in a post-apocalyptic setting or you become one of the crazy mindless people.
Yeah, but if you're in like a survivalist setting, like alive, right? You know, you crash land in the Andes and these people are already dead. Yeah, you eat them because that's how you survive. And right. That's the genre convention that makes you go, oh, wow, this is dire circumstances.
Right.
In a setting like Dragon Ball Z, which is like crazy over the top anime, you can undo a genocide, right? Like someone can kill literally every single person on planet Earth, totally happened, and then everyone can just be wished back to life. So like it's not, I don't know, can you forgive the person who did that? Sure, why not? Everyone's alive and no worse for wear, except for PTSD, I suppose.
So what about the players at the table? How do they inform the moral event horizon?
I think when I think about our table, to me, it's almost like they're pretty much everything in determining how far is too far, right? Because I think our table is very open to maybe doing things for the greater good or maybe looking the other way while something bad is happening. You know, we have a table where at the end of the Morning Glory campaign, Bastion betrays the party and therefore betrays 60% of the multiverse. And like even now I think Brand, like you are the only one who's like, oh, we shouldn't like raise him from the dead. Everyone else is like, well, I think we can give him a chance.
Yeah. Yep. Go ahead and vote on which way you see that one being correct. Really don't understand why I have to smite the rest of the party too.
But yeah, some tables, you know, really want to play heroic games. And so like the event horizon may be sort of much lower, right? Like one murder, right? Like one unreasonable killing is enough to be like, I don't even know what you're doing here. Like you can't be like in this game anymore. Not as like a player, but like, you know, in character.
Yeah.
Another thing to consider is, I guess what I might call distance. And this is a very human thing. Like the time and place in which an atrocity happens really informs the way that people feel about it, whether that's the player or like the character within the game. So did the bad thing that this person did that happen to people who are very far away, or did it happen a long time ago? Or maybe like it was pervasive. It happened on like this mass scale, but it happened to people that the party doesn't know, like these faceless people that they can't really identify with. It's a lot easier to get sort of worked up over one transgression that is against a single person that the PCs actually care about than it is about a large group of people that they don't know anything about.
Yeah, it's like narrative proximity, right? Like if it's front and center in the narrative, then it becomes very important and visceral to the players and their characters. If it happens in the background of the setting or kind of off camera, then they tend to care a little bit less.
Yeah, it's something to consider when you're actually trying to get a rise out of your party, is that you can have someone who's committed war crimes far away, and it's possible that they just don't care. But if they treat a friend of the party poorly or a family member of the party poorly, or, you know, kill them, that might be all that you need for them to have an undying hatred for this person, and, you know, suddenly they're the BBEG.
Right.
I've been watching Handmaid's Tale, which is really difficult because it's too real. But so no spoilers, but there's a character that like is instrumental in sort of building this fascist society where women are chattel slaves, right? And I see a lot of like talk online where people are like, oh, I'm really hoping for like a redemption arc. I'm really excited to like see them you know, realize that they're wrong. And I'm just like, nah. Okay, you can realize that you're wrong at this point, but like, you set up Nazi Germany and built concentration camps. Like, I don't care if you have like an epiphany about like how you're a bad person, you know, like you grew into Nuremberg, okay? And I mentioned before, but it's really important, I think, for verisimilitude. If you as a GM have a redemption arc planned for a particular character, you need to make sure that they have not crossed the event horizon earlier inadvertently, and you need to gauge whether or not your players think they have, because otherwise, you know, you've got redemption arc set up in act three, and you're gonna have a player be like, wait a minute, are we forgetting what they did like back in town? Are you kidding me? No, like they have to die.
Yeah, and the flip side is true too. If you want to ensure that a villain is over that line, right, that you aren't forgetting, and this is less of a BBEG but more of just a general bad person, right? Like, you want to remind the players themselves pretty often of what it is they've done and why they're bad, right? You kind of shut down the optimistic players wanting redemption by, you know, introducing them as Malik the Butcher. No one's going to pretend that guy is redeemable, as opposed to Malik, the guy from that town that you were in like 6 weeks ago.
Malik, like the butcher who has a shop next to the baker and the candlestick maker.
Yeah, exactly.
it's an unfortunate moniker. I get a lot of flack for it.
Yeah.
So you're going to deal with the event horizon in different ways when you're dealing with NPCs or PCs. So let's talk about NPCs a bit. It's always really interesting to have NPCs in your game whose motives are unknown. Or maybe a little inscrutable to the party. You know, are they on the party's side? Are they evil? Are they just a selfish person? And there are a couple different paths to take with this. So you can do the slow reveal of evil that definitely exists, right? You've got this evil character, but the party doesn't necessarily know it yet. So the crossing of the event horizon like has occurred in the background. The party doesn't know, and you're just slowly revealing it to them. This is nice if the BBEG is hiding in plain sight. You know, turns out it was the mayor all along. Or, you know, if they befriend the party and are betraying them later. You want to slowly escalate their deeds. You know, maybe they do something that's questionable. But if you move too quickly, you end up like this with this caricature of a villain. Like, ah, ha, 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 I tied someone to the railroad tracks. Like, of course I'm evil. Aren't you? You're so stupid. Or there's no mystery.
Yeah. You can also pull it where a character is known to be bad, but not how bad, right? Like, you figure that the mafia boss isn't a great guy. You don't figure that he's planning to, you know, blow up a dirty nuke in the middle of Manhattan.
Yeah, that's exactly it. Like, if the game is that you're playing private investigators, like, your first thought is not, okay, let's go in guns blazing and, like, kill the mafia boss and, like, his entire crew. Unless he's planning to detonate a dirty nuke, in which case maybe you definitely would do that.
Yeah, exactly.
And in order to sort of build this suspense or this mystery, you want to be giving the character plausible deniability for any actions that may seem like they do cross the event horizon. Maybe there's extenuating circumstances. I mean, we've already talked about the succubi, but in a more modern setting, it could be like a legal defense. It was a fit of passion, temporary insanity or something like that. It might even be something that the party totally is on board with and even wants to help out with, like revenge, you know? I am going to go kill this person because they killed my family member. And I think a lot of PCs would be like, yeah, of course, we will help you in this just cause. Until, you know, you find the person and they're like, well, I'm going to torture them first.
Right. Revenge can be another motivator that PCs might be able to identify with and forgive. Certainly, plenty of adventurers are just out there for revenge, so it should hit close to home.
And another nice cover is just incompetence. You know, yes, a terrible thing happened, but I didn't mean for it to happen. I'm just an idiot.
Yeah. That can be a little tough to sell, but always a good Hail Mary.
So whatever actions this character is taking, you want to make sure that someone gets hurt. Maybe it's not the PCs right away, right? Like if they're selfish selfish party members, then it may be that they only really react once something bad happens to them. So you can build it up by having bad things happen to people they don't know, people far away. So that when something actually does happen, hopefully the party sort of feels a bit culpable, like they didn't do anything when it wasn't directly affecting them, and now bad things are happening.
So an alternate path for villainy is the sudden betrayal.
It's always inevitable.
Yeah, I mean, anyone who makes a friend is eventually going to make an enemy out of that friend.
Yeah, you either die a friend or you live long enough to become the enemy.
Right.
So when this happens, you sort of want it to be like a guillotine. Right, you want whatever action crosses the event horizon, like whatever they're doing, you want it to be strong enough that there is no one in the party who's questioning the motives or like the vileness of the act. There's no one who's going, oh, maybe they had a good reason for this. It's just, oh my God, I can't believe they did that, and that's awful.
Yeah, and this sudden does not necessarily mean like unpredictable. A lot of times, like a relationship frays. Right, like you start out like as former companions or party members, or maybe they were like an NPC hireling or something, right? And then that relationship slowly deteriorates. Like you start to kind of struggle to continue to associate with them, and then eventually they finally cross that moral event horizon, and there's just no comeback. And that's a sudden feeling, even though like it was kind of marching down a path. It wasn't a surprise, but it was sudden.
Yeah, it can even put into context previous things that happened that didn't seem like big deals at the time. But now, in the context of the sudden betrayal, it's, oh, this wasn't actually that sudden. We just didn't see it coming.
Right. And then usually when you do this, you're gonna use a monologue, right? Like, no one ever pulls the betrayal without kind of going through that overwrought monologue of, haha, I'm so much smarter than you, and look at my plan all falling into place. And by the way, if you were to somehow stop me, it would be by targeting this linchpin in my operation.
Right, like, I need you to know why I'm doing this. Also, because, like, the GM needs you to know why I'm doing this.
Right.
But you can dress this up. You know, you need to convey this information. It doesn't necessarily have to be like a Bond villain, like, give me 2 minutes to talk about this. You know,
I just don't know what you mean.
You're right. Just you're the GM. Do your monologue. It's awesome.
No, so if you're not going to use the monologue, right, like, what else could you do?
You can have them leave clues, right? Like, if you can find a way to let the PCs figure it out on their own when this character isn't there because of, like, the actions that have occurred, they can see the chaos or the damage left behind. Or you can have another NPC just explain it in the same way, but you don't have, like, the cacklingly evil person standing there. You can just have the NPC be like, oh my God, like...
The witness.
Yeah. Barry's a cyborg.
Yeah, exactly.
And if you've got, like, really smart players, they might maybe figure it out on their own, and that's great. And if there's anything left, then you have the NPC explain. And if they just do not get it, then, yeah, you bring in the NPC and they can explain it, or you can monologue, whatever you want.
Or, you know, you can use like intelligence checks or insight or something like that to give a little like GM prompting. Like, here's what happened. This is what your PCs understand. Like, here are the pieces that they put together.
Right, without you actually like in character having to give a monologue.
Right.
So it's also possible that you want to get really close to the event horizon, but you don't want to cross it. Because what you're really looking for is a redemption arc. And I would say when you're trying to do this, the first thing you really want to make sure you've got is buy-in from the players. If you have a party who isn't interested in helping someone be the best version of themselves or like handing out forgiveness, if they just want to like kick in doors and take stuff, don't do the redemption arc.
Yeah. So get that buy-in, whether it's through, you know, some parameters within the story that indicate that this person is important. Prophecy is a great excuse, or maybe like, you know, the heir to a seat of power or something like that. You can't just outright kill them. You need to redeem them. You need to make them see the wrongness of their ways.
Yeah, or they know the party, they're a family member or a friend or someone from a backstory.
Right.
Well, a nice way to do this is Schrodinger's villain. You don't necessarily need to have planned out whether this character redeems himself or not, because you want to give the character's agency. So make the decision dependent on the player actions, right? You've got that like final confrontation. So the villain is always walking the line, like, am I going to finally cross over to the dark side? Like, I'm doing bad things, but I'm still kind of redeemable. So great, have the confrontation, and the party gets to like be really persuasive or threatening or like caring or sneaky and lie, whatever they decide to do. And if they're successful, if they're good at this and roll well enough and roleplay well enough, then yeah, the character does what the party wants and like is redeemed. And if they screw it up or make a bad decision, then, you know, go screw. I'm going dark side, baby.
Yeah, I actually would say that almost every villain should be a Schrodinger's villain, and even to the point that like a BBEG, right? Because ultimately, if the party wants to do this, wants to redeem them rather than kill them, very, very few villains and stories are going to be worse off for having tried, you know? And they might fail and end up having to kill them, and that's fine. But like, it's a pretty hard line to draw as the GM to say that there is just no way that you would even think to attempt to redeem somebody.
What if they've committed one genocide?
I mean, that's where I draw the line. Like, and maybe it's possible that the difficulty is just very, very high to try and redeem somebody who is willing to do that, right? But part of the event horizon, it's less about what they're capable of doing. Like, it's potentially possible that somebody who was once able to commit genocide is now able to become a fully good, you know, inscrutably good person. I'm just not willing to let them. Like, that's what the moral event horizon is, right? It's the justice aspect of the irredeemable act, not the actual like factual redeemability.
See, I actually totally agree with you on like the let them try, because I love the role playing opportunities that trying to redeem even someone so awful that they have committed genocide opens up.
Yeah.
Right? Especially in a game where, you know, there are things like resurrection and you have immortal souls that, you know, like go to higher or lower planes and things like that, you know? And also it sets up the opportunity for the BBEG to really prove that they're a terrible person and still screw over the party because they let them live.
Yeah. And I mean, also you can get into this thing where the party can win and redeem the evil villain, make them see that they are wrong, but then also see that they've crossed their own moral event horizon, right? Like you've moved the goalposts such that now they have recognized they're the villain and they're no longer willing to deal with themselves, right? So you get that kind of like pleading for justice or, I mean, suicide or righteous sacrifice or something like that in the name of good as your act of redemption as a villain.
Yeah, it's not an either or. It's not like I succeed and am evil, or like I'm good and now I join the party.
Right,
like,
yeah,
It can be, you're right, I was totally wrong and I'm sorry for what I did and like I deserve death and I'm put to death.
Right.
Now, if you do have a party who just like cannot get it into their heads that this is a very bad person, be prepared to double down on like the big evil thing that you did.
Yeah.
You know, like... You're like, aha, I have killed your friend. And they're like, you know, I just feel like if we talk to them,
that could be saved. Right. I just betrayed 60% of existence. I really feel like maybe if we resurrect him, it would be good.
If you really want to drive home that, like, you could try to save them, but they're definitely going to betray you when you put them in jail. Like, double down on it. You know, like, they had a contingency plan, and great, like, one of your families is dead now, you know?
Yeah. Just keep in mind, it doesn't always work, because Batman still won't kill the Joker.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, even after the Joker kills poor old Jason Todd. Poor Jason Todd.
Or, what's her name? The Killing Joke. That one.
Yeah, what's her name? Barbara Gordon.
That's it.
Poor Barbara Gordon. Although she rose like a phoenix on the internet to become Oracle, who's cool.
I don't know enough of this. I just know that the Killing Joke had a really bad event, a moral event horizon, and I don't actually even know what it is.
It's bad.
Inspector Gordon's... Inspector? Commissioner Gordon? I don't even know the characters.
Yes, yeah. It's, I'm bad it's at Inspector Batman. Gordon, and it's Commissioner Gadget. Okay? Get this
okay,
straight.
Okay, good. Yeah. So when Batman defeats Claw, does he put them in jail?
But it's not actually Claw. It's just a Claw attached to a bomb. it's really interesting that you bring up Killing Joke, because that's one of my problems with it, is that, like, Joker completely crosses my moral event horizon in that comic, and I'm just like, why aren't you killing him? Just kill him.
But
Batman doesn't do that.
Yeah, I think the problematic nature of that one is just that it crosses the event horizon for what people are willing to read and pay money for, right? So there's, like, kind of a meta problem with the Killing Joke of people are like, this doesn't need to be a story.
At us. Come on, people, at us.
Yeah, at me. Somebody who doesn't even know the plot of the Killing Joke and only knows the meta commentary around it. At me. All right. So how about for PCs? Because you're going to have a little less narrative control when it comes to your player characters.
Yeah, like, who knows when other people are going to say, whoa, that crosses my line, and now I have to kill you in your sleep. Just remember that morally repugnant actions are so much easier to work into your backstory. So, like, I've talked before about my favorite character that I've ever played was my 4E character, Solomon the Stag, who was a terrible, terrible person prior to level 1.
Yep.
Now he's kind of sort of redeeming himself. I mean, he's still awful, but, like, his actions are good. Just in the past, he's murdered a bunch of people.
But not enough to be a genocide.
Well, he's now on the side of the angels, literally, because he's being forced to be, because this whole backstory was that he's being geshed to be a good person. So that was sort of like, oh, here's why we're not punishing you. Like, this is your penance already.
Oh, okay. You're not actually becoming a good person. You're just not allowed to be bad anymore.
That was exactly it. I was like, how can I be a huge jerk but still play someone who's lawful good?
Right. So Warlock patrons are another example of this, where, you know, typically making a deal with the devil is a rather repugnant action. But if you do it in your backstory as part of level 1 and getting that Warlock patron, then we kind of look the other way.
Yeah, and I mean, half the reason people pick Fiend patrons is that it's really fun to walk the line with a character. You know, like, we're role-playing. One of the reasons that we like doing this hobby is that you can do things that you don't do in real life. For some people, that's smashing down doors, and for other people, it's like kind of being, like, morally gray and, like, not a good person.
Yeah.
So you do really want to keep tabs on what it is that the other party members will accept. You know, like, it's actually fine to be a murder hobo if the whole party is full of murder hobos.
Mm-hmm. Yep, and a little bit less so if the whole party is not.
Yeah, like, that's the problems that people always say, like, oh, there's one murder hobo in the party, you know? Yeah, that's a huge problem. You really need to tone it down so that the rest of the party doesn't make sure that you stop doing that by murdering you.
Right.
So you want to make sure that you're not needlessly antagonizing other people in the party. And, you know, it's kind of fun maybe a little to, like, chide the paladin or banter a little bit with, like, the neutral good cleric, but you don't want to piss them off. You don't want to piss off the character, and you don't want to piss off the other player who's just sort of, like, tired of having the story revolve around your antics.
Yeah.
But you do want to, like, feel free to test the boundaries. You know, you do need to figure out what it is that they're okay with. That doesn't necessarily mean, like, are you okay with me stabbing people as you stab someone? have conversations.
Yeah, I mean, that's an important thing. Like, because it can be very difficult in a way, because you're talking about subordinating your agency to the greater group, or one person objecting to somebody else and trying to restrict their agency, right? So, like, if I say, all right, well, I'm going to rob the church before we leave town, like, the natural inkling of the better-natured characters in the group is going to be like, we aren't going to let you do that, right? Like we're not going to continue to associate with somebody who is robbing churches. Like, that's not what we do. And so you end up in this issue of, like, me playing my character is now in direct conflict with what you're doing, and you're crossing that line. Like, you need to have a conversation above the table to say, like, okay, are you really doing this? And do we really want to deal with these consequences? Or are you not going to do that? Or are you going to do it underhanded or hidden or whatever, right? And as a group, are we all agreeing that we're going to kind of structure our session in this way or structure our campaign in this way?
Yeah, I think our group has done a pretty nice job. Like, in the game that you're running right now, the Dynasty Unwarranted campaign, like, everyone at the table knows that Doc is doing heretical things. Which
most people in the party are pretty sure he's doing heretical things.
They but just don't have, like, proof that they can't, like, explain away somehow, right?
Right, right.
Like, they have not yet been forced to confront that, like, oh, undeniably, Doc is doing heretical things.
Right.
So there's this dramatic irony where the players know and the characters have an inkling, but this is still happening. If it occurred in the open, like, the party wouldn't work at all together because, like, we couldn't actually function.
Right. You would all be heretics by letting him do this. So
right.
Those of you who are loyalists, of which there are numerous members of the party who are truly loyalist Imperials, like, would have to put him to death. Burn the heretic.
And I mean, you know, it's fun knowing that that's coming.
Yeah. It's especially fun for Cameron, who is playing Doc.
Yeah, well, I mean, there's also the chance that his betrayal is, like, murdering all of us or summoning a terrible demon, and, like, that's our big battle.
No spoilers.
I also think it's interesting to remember that the event horizon, especially when dealing with other players, does not necessarily need to be good versus evil. It can be, like, a law chaos thing. It can be what the characters have decided is something that is important to them. Like, if you're in a mercenary group, it could be that, like, it's fine to kill anyone who's not a member of the group, but you don't go back on a contract.
Right.
Or in the Imperial Guard, like, you don't retreat. You know, that crosses the Imperial Guard's moral event horizon. You are okay to kill. You are an enemy if you retreat.
Well, yeah. You are an enemy if you retreat in front of a commissar.
Okay, crosses the commissar's event horizon.
Right. But notably, you know, it's pretty rare in 40K that commissars are shot by their own men.
Yeah, that's interesting. You'd think it would happen more.
It's actually not.
I mean, percentage-wise, it's low, but given the numbers...
Yeah, there's a culling.
Right, a billion commissars across the galaxy die every day shot by their own men.
Right.
And then if you are sort of playing underhanded when dealing with the rest of the party, even if it's dramatically ironic, just keep in mind that you can't necessarily expect that you're going to be able to plan out either a redemption arc or a betrayal arc for your character, because you don't necessarily know when the big reveal is going to come, right? Because if you're hiding things all the time, hiding these actions, it could just be that, like, a poor die roll on your part or a really good one on someone else's means that you got caught, and then that could just be it, you know? Like, you got caught with that terrible demonic ritual that you've been hiding from everyone because, like, your stealth check was terrible.
Now the jig is up.
Yeah, and I guess they're probably going to kill you. But, I mean, wondering if that's going to happen was part of the fun. So, like, enjoy that.
Yeah.
And know that, like, it's going to come, and don't, like, get whiny if people are like, oh, we have to kill you now.
Well, so it's interesting because that sort of hidden potential for betrayal was in the Morning Glory campaign was the definition of Bastion's character, right? Like, to the end. We kind of all knew he was evil. We just didn't know how evil he was. So his betrayal was not a surprise. It was just a confirmation. But the flip side was true for Brand, where everybody to the end, insisted he must be evil because he was an inquisitor, and then he held firm and wished the party to success in the final battle.
Hey, what's Bran's position on the shifter genocide?
It was an oversight. Clerical issue. It's bureaucratic stuff.
Yes. It got cleric and paladin issue. Yes.
It was before his time.
Hey, good thing.
Yeah. Look, I'm not saying that the Church of the Silver Flame isn't flawless. What I'm saying is that mistakes have been made.
I mean, there were, you know, good people on both sides.
It was the right thing to do at the time.
Not so much for the shifters, but you know.
It was,
you know,
the wrong thing with retrospect.
yes, I was lawful good in retrospect.
Right. Listen, we got rid of a lot of evil shifters too.
Yeah, pretty much all of them.
Yeah. No, I don't think Bran was okay with a shifter genocide. I think Bran saw that as like a black mark.
I mean, he doesn't get points for that. That's good.
Yeah, I know. No. It's like, but what can you do, right? Like, it's a faith-based organization, and he's serving a literal deity. So what can you do?
You know, the only reason the shifter genocide happened is because the shifters got access to time travel and kept going back in time to try to kill the Keeper.
Yeah,
and
actually,
the Keeper was like, oh, we gotta get kill all these shifters.
You know, I mean, it wasn't the sole factor, but Bran did systematically dismantle the Church of the Silver Flame and rebuild it. So, like, you know, it wasn't really up for debate. He was pretty against it when I reconsider his full course of action.
Yeah, it's Vatican III. It's good. It's
yeah,
good.
Exactly. dear. Do you hear that, Ishan?
It's the sound of one genocide. Okay, one.
I guess we're going to have to roll up a few more characters, so let's move on to the Character Creation Forge. But before we do that, let's talk about how our listeners can get in contact with us.
We do love hearing from you.
You can tweet at Shane, at Mundangerous, that's M-U-N dangerous.
And you can tweet at Ishan, at EvilSendsCarne, that's malice minus meat.
And you can tweet at the show, at TPTCast.
You can also email us at TotalPartyThrill@gmail.com.
And you can find us on the web at www.TotalPartyThrillCast.com.
We're also on Facebook and Instagram at TotalPartyThrill.
So this week in the Character Creation Forge, we are building Sub-Zero, a refrigerator.
Actually, this is a character from the video game Mortal Kombat. Strange that this was not your suggestion, because you are typically the video game guy.
True.
Although, I did actually play Mortal Kombat.
Well, you played Mortal Kombat 2.
Yeah.
I also played Mortal Kombat 2.
I think I played some Mortal Kombat 1, now that I think about it, because I'm very old.
I rented Mortal Kombat 1. My neighbor owned Mortal Kombat 2,
so I
played Mortal Kombat
2. Video?
It was definitely at a Blockbuster video. Yeah. So side by side, it was clear Mortal Kombat 2 was the better game.
I mean, I would hope so.
Yeah.
Just like Mortal Kombat 2 Annihilation, the movie, was far superior to the first Mortal Kombat movie.
I don't know how you know that.
I saw both in theaters.
I don't know why you did that.
Yeah.
All right, so who is Sub-Zero, other than a character from Mortal Kombat?
Well, so in the game, he's descended from Cryomancer, so he's got control over ice and cold, and of course, being in a fighting video game, he's a skilled hand-to-hand combatant.
Yeah, his big ability is that he can throw a ball of ice at his enemies that causes them to freeze, which then allows him to walk up and uppercut them repeatedly.
Yeah, let's see, he also shoots a bigger ball of ice, which goes faster and freezes them a little longer. He can turn the ground beneath his opponent's feet into ice so that they slip and fall.
And then as his animality, he can turn into a polar bear and maul them to death.
Yeah, I remember that. Yeah. He also did a thing, one of his fatalities was like freezing someone solid, right? And then punching them and they shatter.
They shatter, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, so how do we do this with old Sub-Zero?
The build is Open Hand Monk 10, Arctic Druid 9, Arcana Cleric 1.
All right.
So I tried to do Four Elements Monk, right? Because it just makes sense thematically, but it's just really bad, especially if you're trying to limit yourself to one element.
Yeah.
This is really, really bad.
So we'll figure we'll just get good at the martial arts instead.
Yeah. You know, you get martial arts, flurry, extra attack. You get stunning fist, which is a nice way to show that he's frozen someone.
Mm-hmm. Stun is a super good effect. It's short term, but so is Sub-Zero's freeze, so it fits quite nicely.
You get evasion, and then from open hand, you get an at-will prone, which you can definitely flavor as forming ice underneath someone's feet. You can also make it so they can't take any reactions, which of course is going to be similar to freezing them.
Now, from Druid, we're focusing on a little more ranged ice attacks, as well as, of course, our animality. So we'll get Frostbite, Shape Water, and Ice Knife.
You also get Hold Person, Sleet Storm, which creates some difficult terrain in an area, and Ice Storm, which will batter people with large chunks of ice. The selection of Arctic means that you also get access to the Slow spell, which of course you're going to flavor as freezing them, and Cone of Cold. And recall that if you reduce someone to zero hit points with Cone of Cold, they freeze solid. Now, we choose one level of a cleric here because the first level of Arcana Cleric lets us choose two wizard cantrips, but they count as cleric spells, which means that they are based off of wisdom instead of using something like Magic Initiate to get them where you need to use intelligence, because you're picking Ray of Frost, which lets you slow someone's speed. Of course, it freezes them a little bit more. It's kind of a theme to this
really,
character.
Really repetitive theme, yeah. You've got a lot of ways to freeze.
As for leveling order, I would take Monk to 5, so you have your extra attack and your Stunning Fist. Go ahead and knock out your Arcana Cleric, just so you've got your Ray of Frost at will, and then I would take Druid all the way to 9 before finishing out Monk.
All right, before we wrap up, we want to take a moment to thank our Patreon supporters.
Yeah, your support is what makes it possible for us to keep doing this show every single week. So if you'd like to learn more, you can check out our rewards at patreon.com/totalpartythrill.
So what do we have planned for next week's episode?
We're talking about targeting PCs.
And in the Character Creation Forge?
We are building the homing missile.
Well, that's it for episode 154 of Total Party Thrill. I hope we lived up to our name, but either way, I'm Shane.
And I'm Ishan. Thanks for listening.